Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to a beautiful podcast. I'm your host, Spring Developer Advocate Josh Long, and this show is all about the real heroes behind Spring and its ecosystem.
Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to another installment of a beautiful podcast. It has been quite a week indeed since we last spoke. There has been a ton of activity in the community, stuff that I love to see, and stuff that I think is going to be ramping up in terms of activity, in terms of frequency in the weeks ahead as we march towards Q3 and 4, and of course our big tentpole conference, Spring 1. We've seen just in the last week new releases of Spring Boot, Spring Batch, Spring Integration, Spring Tools, etc., and so much more. Very importantly, very saliently, we've seen the first milestone of Spring Framework 5.3 is now available. 5.3 is designed as the final 5.x feature release, wrapping up the major themes in the Spring Framework 5 generation. This release will support or finalize or wrap up the theme for reactive programming for Kotlin, while also taking our GraalVM compatibility to the next level. Last but not least, we're of course preparing for Java 15 and Java 16, and also for Java 17, right, which is the next LTS release, and expecting an extended 5.3.x maintenance lifecycle. There's a new module in 5.3, which is kind of interesting. I think it's going to be super useful, which is Spring-R2DBC. Now, R2DBC, of course, is the Reactive Relational Database Connectivity Abstraction that we developed and that has evolved sort of in tandem with the other Spring projects, and which has, in the last 6 months, seen integrations in Spring Boot and in Spring Data and so on. I guess maybe 6 months, a year, something like that. So that's now actually being folded into Spring Framework proper, which is interesting. This is kind of analogous to the Spring-JDBC module. While R2DBC already has a lot of good features there, you can expect to see some, you know, small refinements being added to the final release, you know, between now and then. The first milestone also includes GraalVM native support. We've actually removed or refactored a lot of the code that made it otherwise impossible to do a raw native image out of the Spring's dispatcher servlet, for example. We've also fixed certain things that we had to otherwise disable through properties like spring.spell.ignore and spring.xmlignore. These properties were, you know, important in getting us to the point where we are now, but it would be nice to have no need for them in the first place. And so now the Spring GraalVM native project is going to track Spring Framework 5.3 milestones from here on down. Revisiting, of course, Spring's web support is a big theme in Spring Framework 5.3, and Spring MVC will come with a path pattern class for parsing and efficient URL matching, and Spring WebFlux will also come with a completely new and fully reactive multi-part parser implementation, plus further refinements in 5.3 M1. A second milestone is planned for early August, including data binding, Java 14 record classes. Well, actually, it's a preview feature in Java 14, as well as Kotlin 1.4 and Kotlin.x, Kotlin.x dot serialization support for JSON with Spring MVC. The release candidate is planned for mid-September, with general availability expected in late October. So that's all really, really cool. I mean, this is all a lot of big things landing in one big release, getting, picture perfect, API perfect. I'm super excited about it because obviously the support that's been there for Kotlin is already amazing, right? I can already use it in production. It's already been very, very good. And the support for Spring GraalVM, Spring and GraalVM is legendary, right? I've already done 2 Spring tips on that very topic just this year alone. And the project is getting better. And the entire team has been working on it, right? It's been one of those things where across the entire portfolio, we've seen engineers and different projects pitching in to change whatever's needed to be able to make it so that this is a natural first-class citizen for anybody who wants to create native images with Spring. All that, really, really exciting. To see that all come together so quickly, so nicely, is just, for me, it's a joy, right? Because it means that a lot of these things I've been hoping to use as GA will all just land at once. A lot of these things already are GA, but just the idea that I can have all these things, you know, in one place, and there's no milestone repositories that are going to be required in, you know, just a short while, right? And when Spring Framework 5.3 comes out, that's awesome. I cannot wait. So that's good stuff. That's all today, right? I'm also excited about the future, right? I've got some exciting upcoming virtual appearances. I've been doing a lot of online presentations this year. Most of the time, I announce where I'm landing as I land there, and I do my level-headed best to, when I remember, to tweet out or retweet any advance notices of where I'm going to be. But I don't really do a great job of advertising my appearances, and the reason is because that's their job. I mean, I go to so many different places. I don't really have it in my head to be able to announce everything. But now, since all the things I'm going to be doing are online, that means that any of you can join it. So I'm going to try and do a level-headed best to announce those, because if they're public, there's no reason you couldn't join me, right? It doesn't matter what geography you're in or what you're doing, because you don't have to get out of your seat, right? You don't have to change a venue for this. So several of them coming up in just the next few weeks, in first few weeks of July, which is where we are, by the way, right now. For those of you who supported, happy belated Canada Day and happy early 4th of July in this, here in the States. I'll be doing virtual appearances this month. So, for example, I'll be doing one for the London Java community, so you can find that. One for the Accento Digital Conference, one for the Rockla Java User Group, and one for the JetBrains Java Day online event. And I'll be speaking at the upcoming Spring One Tour online event. I'll be speaking twice. That's right. If you hadn't gotten enough already in the first ridiculous hour of presentation, I think I've got two extra hours. So I'm doing two different presentations, one of which is 2 hours long. So please join me for that. Maybe they're both 2 hours. I don't know. Either way, I'm excited to be there. I hope you'll be there. Register now. Most of these events are free, right? So that's the other barrier that typically precludes people from being able to make it. If the geography wasn't it, it's going to be the price. And then the people that still make it, I am so grateful for all of them. But now these things are free and they're online. So a lot of the barriers have gone away. We've sort of democratized the public square a little bit there in that one respect. Now then, we've got a super exciting show today. Today I'm talking to Jordan Kartsov, who's a PhD in particle physics, and who we're going to be talking to about instrumenting and visualizing the Linux kernel. I learned a ton, and reminisced a little bit. He's in Bulgaria, a place I have a lot of great memories in, and of about which I can not help but talk because I've got so many fun stories there. And so I learned a lot. We reminisced. We had a lot of fun. I hope you enjoy. I hope you learned something. See you next time.
I think we're recording.
Okay, good.
All right. I'm always unsure about this. This is the scariest part for me about any of these podcasts, because I had one interview with Malak Gupta, who's a very famous Java developer and engineer and teacher and book writer, very famous. And I was very excited to have her do an interview for me on the podcast. And I pressed the button. I swear I pressed the button. And then to make sure it was okay, I stopped it to listen to the audio to make sure it was okay and we were both there. Mm-hmm. And then I must have forgotten to start again, right? And so I said, oh, whew, it worked. And then we had a whole conversation and I forgot to record again. And, I had to beg her, please, can we please do one more? I'm so sorry, you know? She was so nice. She was so nice to me. I don't know why I was so dumb, you know, but anyway. Anyway, good morning. You're in Sofia, Bulgaria.
Yes.
So it's morning for you, late in the evening for me. And can you explain who you are? Can you introduce yourself to the audience?
Hello, I'm Jordan. I'm an open source engineer, part of the Open Source Technology Center at VMware. I'm working from the Sofia office of VMware. Something interesting about me is that before joining VMware, I used to be experimental physicist, not a software engineer. I worked for a bunch of particle physics experiments, developing software. And at some point, I decided to switch and actually became a real software engineer. But yeah, I have a PhD in particle physics, so And now I have a lot of fun developing open source for VMware.
I love it.
It's not so different. I mean, the way the academic or scientific community works and the way the open source community works, there are a lot of similarities between those two communities.
Yeah. Wait, you said you have a PhD?
Yes.
So you're a doctor. So you are now listed among my favorite kind of people. You see, on the Spring team, the team that I work on, we have two other PhDs in physics, right? Dr. Sire, Dr. Dave Sire, and Dr. Mark Pollock. And, you know, whenever I do presentations on stage, I like to talk about my favorite doctors, Dr. Who, Dr. Pollock, Dr. Sire, Dr. Strange, Dr. Seuss, you know, all the normal superhero doctors. And now I have you as well. So I'm so excited to add you to the list. So
this is not something so extraordinary to have a physicist switching to another engineering kind of.
Yeah. But it is extraordinary to get a PhD, and that's awesome. Congratulations. It's an inspiration. So you are now, you worked in particle physics, and that's a really interesting field. Why did you leave that field?
Well, I guess I wanted to try something new. Particle physics includes a lot of programming. I mean, the experiments are extremely complicated machines, if you want to put it like this, and which are controlled by software. The data is processed by software. So a lot of software involved in the particle physics. And at some point, I realized that actually I'm doing 90% programming, 10% physics. So I decided, why not just switching to professional programming?
And right.
It's interesting because, the physicists have their kind of their own way of programming, which is not exactly the same as the software is being developed in the big corporations like VMware. I think they're doing quite well.
Okay. And so then what kind of software were you using then? Was it Pascal? Was it?
No. So as already mentioned, so physicists have their own way of programming. So they have also their own slang when they speak about programming.
Right.
I've been looking for the front end, but actually in programming for physicists, front end is exactly the opposite to what you mean in
traditional world.
Well, because for physicists, they always think about the stream of data. So the front end is the place where the data gets created, and then the data streams through your software, and back end is the like the end
user of interface
when the human being can actually see and understands the data. So
it's awesome. Yeah, so, I didn't realize that.
Working for the very front end, I mean the processing of the analog signals, digitization of those signals, then pre-processing with FPGAs, then communication between the FPGAs and the CPUs. So this part of the software.
Very, very cool. Very, very cool. So then you decided to just move into more general purpose software, right?
Yeah.
And so, but you studied physics, and you now live in Bulgaria, Sofia, Bulgaria, right?
I moved to Bulgaria. So I spent 6 years working for University of Geneva in Switzerland.
Nice.
I started.
I spoke at CERN a few years ago.
Well, I've been working for some of the experiments at CERN as well, but also for experiments in UK, in US as well. I don't know if you know Fermilab. That's the US equivalent of CERN. It's near
Chicago. I haven't spoken there. Yeah. That's cool. Wow, that's so cool. So you're in Bulgaria now. I love Bulgaria. I mean, I love Switzerland. Don't get me wrong, but Bulgaria. I was telling you before the show. I love Bulgaria. There's a conference there called Java 2 Days that I used to go to all the time. And I right now, if I could go there right now and see my friends there, I would go there right now. You know, it's the coronavirus makes it difficult. But some of my best memories are there, and actually some of the holes in my memory are from Bulgaria, because I've had nights where too much rakia and not enough brains, and next morning I'm like, I sure hope I didn't do something unrespectable, like, or disrespectable, like a PHP code or something, you know. I worry about that. But yeah, I love Bulgaria, and I met Jean-Claude Van Damme there in your beautiful country. So memories.
Well, it's a really good place for nightclubbing. Yeah, it's
and engineering. Great engineers.
And engineering. Yeah.
There's three different Java conferences there, big ones with more than 1,000 people each. And that's awesome. You know, one city, Sofia, has these big conferences, which I think is wow, you know. And I've always had such a wonderful time there, and I love the food. You know, I love the food and the drink and the and then the food that you eat after you've had too much to drink, like the something like this.
Skimbecha.
How you pronounce that? Yeah. The tripe soup. Yeah. The tripe soup, right? It's like stomach, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So that's, yeah. Anyway, great memories. Oh, you've made me very sad. I want to go to Bulgaria again. And you work out of, when we're not under coronavirus, right? You work out of the VMware Sofia office, yeah?
Yes. Yes.
So I have been to this office many times. I was there in 2011, I guess, or 10, maybe 10. That was right after it was acquired. That used to be a separate consulting business. Is that true?
Well, I don't know so well the history, but I think everything in Bulgaria started with the acquisition of one small software company here in Sofia. Then the Sofia site is growing and growing, and actually now we are moving to another location because the two buildings that we had so far are not big enough to call the office. So the office is moving. So next time when you come, it will be you
huge
new office. Yeah.
I love it. And by the way, it was never small. As I understand it, even the consulting business that was there before, even though it's smaller, it was still very big, and that's because there's a huge software business in Sofia. Amazing engineers, amazing. And I know that a lot of people there do work for the rest of Europe, right? So you have some of these great engineers working on really interesting problems.
That's actually very true. And I mean, for Sofia, if you see the fraction of the software industry as a part of the GDP of the country, it's really huge. I mean,
so cool. That is so cool. I love it. I love Sofia. So you're very lucky, and I feel very happy to think about these wonderful experiences I had there. So now, what do you work on? We haven't actually gotten to that part yet, which is, you know, you're at VMware, and then what do you do?
Well, I'm working on one open source project called Kernel Shark, and actually it's interesting that working on this project, I can actually use a lot of my experience as a physicist. Because the Kernel Shark is an instrument for analyzing and visualizing the process that are going on your system, Linux for the moment, but we are trying right now to extend it to ESXi as well. So if you really want to understand what is going on in the system, what really runs on your CPU, that's the tool for you. You can really see everything that is going on in the system with tracing, and then you can analyze the recorded data with Kernel Shark.
So Kernel Shark is an open source project. Where is it hosted?
It's hosted at kernel.org. That's the...
Okay.
Kernel.
So it's part of the kernel, or it's by the same...
Well, it's not officially part of the kernel, but yeah, it uses the same infrastructure for...
Okay. And so it's developed in cooperation with the Linux kernel developers as well, who built it to help make it easier to understand what's happening in the kernel. Is that fair?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated. So original Kernel Shark was started as a project 10 years ago. But at some point people started realizing that there are some limitations in the design, and also there are a lot of very Linux specific things in the design of Kernel Shack. So together with Steven Rosted, my team lead, we decided to just rewrite everything from scratch using the lessons learned from the old version. And we wanted to make it really general purpose, not something which is just for Linux, but a general purpose instrument, which can be used for any kind of tracing data and can be used with ESXi later, maybe, or also with other hypervisors, with KVM, not just proprietary products. Yeah. So we started rewriting from scratch. We have version 1 available right now. We are working on version 2 right now, which includes some changes in the API. But yeah, we want to extend it to tracing user space, tracing containers.
That's so cool. So you mentioned it works on different hypervisors. So does that mean that I can use Kernel Shark to see what's happening in a hosted environment, or can I also see what's happening in the host itself? Like, why does it matter? What is this Kernel Shark that works on the kernel? What does it need to know about from the host?
It's exactly this. So it's this functionality is still not available in version 1. It will be available in version 2 once we release this version. But yeah, you can see the entire flow of execution, how the processing goes from the host to the guest, then it to the user space, then it goes back to the guests, back to the host. You can see this entire flow of execution. What is really happening on the CPU?
Oh, so it's from the CPU on up. That's a really interesting perspective then. Oh, wow. Okay, so like if I'm like, what kind of information would I can see what's happening on the CPU, but at what level of granularity, or, you know, how specific? What am I looking for there?
Well, it depends from the infrastructure for tracing that you use. On Linux, this infrastructure is extremely well developed. It's really sophisticated, and you can trace absolutely everything. You can see the execution of absolutely every function in the kernel. You can trace also your functions in user space. And there is some tricky moment here, because if you trace too much, then the process of tracing actually changes the behavior of your system. So, it's like a quantum effect. This, you know, this famous
Schrodinger's bug.
The process of observation changes the object of observation. So, you have to be careful. I mean, if you enable tracing absolutely everything, this will basically change your system and you will deform the picture that you see. But so you have to decide what you want to trace. You have to provide the proper settings, and then you get your data.
I see. That's really cool. So, like, if I'm trying to figure out race conditions in a higher level application, because as you know, I work at a higher level in my Java code and my Spring applications. So I'm trying to figure out, like, where would I reach for this? Where would I need this? Is it usually used for performance, or is it for just understanding the call graph of an application, or what is
it can be used for both. So yeah, most of the users right now are using it to understand the performance, basically to solve performance issues, to understand why the data get the time, your CPU time gets spent, what are the bottlenecks of your application. That's the most common way of using it, but you also can use it to understand, for example, some unexpected code paths that are getting executed to follow this.
So that's right.
It's basically a very extremely flexible instrument, and everyone can use it in very different ways.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Okay, so if I'm trying to figure out the code path, that's actually, I think, the kind of interesting thing here, because from the JVM perspective, we have a lot of very good tools to tell us what's happening inside of the JVM, Mm-hmm. Where things get problematic is when our very, very inefficient JVM does things that interact with the kernel, right? Mm-hmm. And I think most people don't have a lot of expertise in the Java ecosystem, well, in general, but especially mm-hmm. the Java ecosystem, with diagnosing issues below the Java application, right?
Well, so, I think this is a kind of a general problem for the modern programming. You have so many layers of abstraction between your user application and the hardware it actually runs on, and it's very easy to lose your way. I mean, understanding what is really happening. And we've been showing an example with a Java Hello World application running on a Linux idle machine and tracing this with Kernel Shark to see all the activities which a Java application creates on your system. And you can see a lot of things. You can, for example, see the garbage collection, the sequence of the garbage collection on each CPU. Yeah, I'm not a Java person, so I really don't understand very well the machinery behind running a Java application. But you can really see all the tasks which are created in the kernel by the Java application, and understand where the memory goes, where the time gets spent.
Right. So when we had the interview with Stephen Rosted, he explained that in the kernel, what a Java program would think of as a thread mm-hmm. is actually tasks, and there's different kinds of tasks, right?
Yep.
Can you explain what some of the different tasks are?
Task is basically a process in the kernel. When you have a multi-threaded process in user space, so each thread is a task in the kernel.
Mm-hmm.
So with this Hello World Java program, we found that actually more than 30 kernel tasks had been created just to run the Hello World program.
Which 30 tasks? Wow. Cool.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a lot. So that means 30 independent executing things, right?
Yeah.
And so
you have one garbage collection task per each CPU core. That's the first thing.
Right.
And then many others. I mean, I'm not a Java person, really, so I haven't tried to dive into understanding the mechanisms. But yeah, you see more than 30 tasks being created when you run one single executable.
That's amazing. So so you've got, okay, so and at the lowest level of the operating system, just for a quick review, if you have four cores, but you have 10 tasks, then each core will get two of them. Is that basically, assuming a fair load balancer?
You have this hyper-threading. So if you have four cores, you actually, the user will see is like, instead of four, you see eight CPU cores because of this hyper-threading mechanism provided by the Intel CPUs. But then if you have even more, then the scheduler of the operating system takes control, and so it will try to schedule the different tasks in a fair way. So some tasks will have a higher priority, some others will have lower priority. So the scheduler will reserve more time for the high priority tasks, less time for the lower priority tasks. And I mean the scheduler itself is a really complicated algorithm, but this is the responsibility of the scheduler.
And does that? So you can see all of that. You can see the priority of these things.
See how the scheduler switches between the tasks. Exactly. Yeah, this you can see with the kernel shell.
That is so cool. Wow. Okay. So once I have kernel shark, what is it, a command line application? Is it a user interface? Like, how do I use it?
Kernel shark right now is a graphical user interface which uses Qt.
Okay.
Part of this rewrite was to actually libraryize the application. So right now the GUI is just like a shell around the library, and the library has a, let's say, relatively simple API which you can use with any visualization tool. So the idea is to create a more like a platform which can integrate with different tools instead of having one monolithic tool. And yeah, the idea behind this is to actually allow to integrate this library with the instruments that VMware already has.
I see. So, okay, that's interesting. So I didn't know that VMware had tools like this. I guess they must because they have so much stuff at the lower level.
They have their own casing tools for ESXi.
Okay, wow, really cool. So and, I could get like a unified
KVM,
view of
it. KVM also uses its own tracing, which can be visualized and analyzed with Kernel Shark. I mean, we are developing for ESXi, but also for KVM. That's open source.
Right. Yeah. I love it. Oh, that's so cool. So, okay. Oh, wow. And so this is an application that I can launch on my machine and then point it to the kernel, and it'll just dump out this information and visualize what's happening for me.
Decoupled from the process of recording. So Kernel Shark is more for visualizing and analyzing the data which is being pre-recorded. You can also use the graphical interface allows you to start recording from the GUI. But this is not a typical way of, most of the people are recording using command line tools, and then they open the data in Kernel Shark.
Interesting. Wow. That's cool. So if you, you mentioned earlier that there's a tension, there's a trade-off between the precision of the sampling versus the performance of the application, right? So is there a way to, how does one find the right middle ground so that it's performant enough to leave it running for a long time, but it also doesn't take away from my performance, you know?
Well, usually people are doing benchmarking. There are standard applications which you can compare the performance with tracing completely disabled and then with your tracing settings and see what is the overhead that gets introduced by the process of tracing itself. But the infrastructure for tracing is designed to be extremely efficient. So if you disable tracing, you see no change in the performance, no overhead. I mean, the overhead is so negligible that it's getting hidden in the noise of your system. So there is no way to measure it. It's so small that there is no way to measure it. Yeah.
But that's really cool.
Once you start tracing, adding more and more things to trace, at some point you will see overhead. And if you just enable tracing every single function in the kernel, you can imagine that this will give you a lot of overhead, which can go to...
So I can do that per function. I can say I want to trace this function here, this whole...
Absolutely. Wow. Yeah, you can say I want to generate a trace every time when this function gets executed. And you can do this for every single... Well, not every single function in the kernel, but basically the limitations is you can't do this for inline functions, and you can't trace the tracing mechanism itself because you go into recursion. Everything else can be traced.
So all the standard POSIX headers, POSIX, all that stuff, I can do fcopy and fopen and all that stuff.
Yeah,
that's really cool. That's super cool. I would love to see what it looks like from the perspective of the host operating system. I would love to be able to see what that host operating system is seeing when I run a Java Spring application on the JVM inside of a Docker container, inside of my Kubernetes cluster, on top of a node, right? That could be inside of VMware.
We are not ready to show this yet, but that's the direction in which we are working. And maybe for the next cycle of open source conferences next year, we'll be able to really demonstrate this and have it released.
That is so cool. Okay. I'm trying to figure out. So I didn't realize that it was able to look at individual functions. That to me is very interesting. What are some of the, there's two kinds of functions that I care about, right? Input, you know, input and output, mm-hmm. right, for I/O, and then I care about computationally sort of demanding functions, right? Things that demand time on the CPU. What functions would I look at if I wanted to figure out how my program is doing input and output, for example? What are some very common functions that people may not realize are being invoked in a typical application?
Well, you should first of all understand when the execution is in user space or in kernel space. So when right. your application is doing some CPU intensive calculations, let's say, this goes completely in user space. So you should then trace just your own function that is doing this. And the easiest way is just to so you have to compile your code with a proper flex. So I'm not sure how this will go for Java, but so for C and C++ is almost trivial. And then you see maybe this is not the most beneficial way of using the tracing, because if you are interested in understanding what your program is doing with the system, that's yes. probably when the place where the tool will really shine. Because you can, for example, trace all system calls that your program is doing to understand.
Right.
All, yeah, that's one thing. But then once you make the system call, it's just like a gate for entering the kernel space. And you don't know what is going on when it goes deeper and deeper. So, for example, why one system call takes 10 times more than another? This you can't understand from user space. So then you should really trace down what the system is doing, and you can then understand what's the issue, what's the performance issue, why you see such a big difference in performance.
Yeah, I haven't used the tool yet, right? So I don't know what my experience is when I use it, but what I'm imagining is that there's some way for me to specify a function name, right? And what I'm trying to figure out is, what are some interesting functions to look at if I'm trying to debug performance problems? Is that the wrong approach? Do I get shown everything by default that I can
function in the kernel or function in user space?
In the kernel, in the JDK, if I do input and output, eventually that has to do work on the kernel, right? That's using low level primitives for opening sockets and all that kind of stuff, right? I'm just trying to figure out, what are some very revealing functions that if I were to trace them, maybe I would be surprised?
Well, the most common way to start is just to start with the system calls and see. So once you make the system call, what is the execution graph under the system call? So the system call will call kernel functions. They will call other kernel functions. So the tracing can actually build the whole graph for you. So you can see the sequence of execution in the kernel, and with function graph tracing in particular, you can see the duration of each of those functions in time. And I don't know if you are familiar with what's called flame graphs. Have you been using flame graphs? So you can basically build a flame graph and understand where the time gets spent inside the kernel.
That is super cool. We use flame graphs for understanding the memory allocation rates in Java applications.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's some very good tooling there, but again, it's always lacking the context of what's happening at the lowest levels, you know. And I think
that's the problem. So the crossing from user space to kernel space is usually not a trivial task because of all the security problems that this can give. And those tools are built as part of the system, just exactly because of this, because you want to provide some level of security when using it. But security guys are trying to hide everything that's going on in the system, and then the tracing guys are like the biggest enemy of the security, because they want to show absolutely everything. And
yeah,
it's like a constant fight between those two.
Why can't they just agree on something? Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. Well, very cool. I didn't know about this technology. I'm very interested in it. Is there any kind of like whole, is there like any kind of a, where do people get started? I guess I'm trying to figure out how I would go get started. Is there a website people can go to? What's the best place
one of the major components that we are missing right now. We don't have a good set of tutorials, but this is definitely in our to-do list. And before releasing Kernel Shark 2, we'll make sure that the website is up to date with good tutorials helping you how to start. Because right now the documentation is in a not so good condition. I have to
admit. Well, that, I mean, that's true. It's ongoing development right now, right? You're trying to move to a new version, so that's fair. Get the design right first, then write the documentation.
Yeah.
I remember the Agile Manifesto says working softer over comprehensive documentation. So get it to work first, then document it. Well, that's very cool.
I'm super good documentation is actually not a trivial task. And
of course.
Almost equally complicated compared
to the document itself. Especially if someone else does it, right? If it's somebody else writing the documentation, they have to figure out what was going on in your head when you wrote the code. They have to understand the code first, then they have to understand the context that was in your head when you wrote it. I think that's way more difficult than just writing the code in the first place, you know?
Yeah, the problem is, so what is obvious for you may not be obvious for others, and you have to really carefully judge but then if you provide too many details, then you have too much of information, which is almost equivalent to having no information. So
almost worse in that case.
Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome. So okay, so is there, so I, if people want to learn more, they go to kernel.org and just search for.
Well, we have kernelshark.org. You can go there. That's probably the first place to go. We have to reconsider updating the website and documentation.
The website is it's effective. It's very functional. It's like, I love the website. It's a, I can see that you are focusing on delivering working software, and that's what matters to me. It's using HTML2. Let's see. Yeah, it needs a little bit of love. Yeah, that's true. But it's very clear, right? And I'm sure it works very well on every device because it's just HTML. It's HTML2 or something. It's not even 4. It's like 3 or 2. Very old, very very easy to read page. So where do people go for the code itself?
I told you, so the original Kernel Shark was developed 10 years ago, and the website is like a legacy from this old, good old version. We have to rewrite the website, absolutely.
I mean, I get what you're saying, my friend, but that website would have been very bad even 10 years ago. the website is, oh, that's so great. I love this website. It's super fast. It's only a few thousand characters, the whole thing, you know, including all the HTML. So, you know, it's got a CGI script in there. Yeah, that's awesome. And it's hosted on, it's a Git repository, not GitHub, but it's a Git repository, right? So people can get the code and try it out. And it's already installed in the kernel, or how do you get it installed on your Unix, Linux distribution?
You mean Kernel Shark or?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, most of the distros right now have Kernel Shark as a package.
Okay.
But there are places, just go to kernel.org, get the code, build it for your own, install it.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
That's easy enough to do. That's very.
Installation process is almost trivial.
Git. I see Git download. What do I need? Kernel Shark 1.0. Oh, there's a how. What? My browser just crashed. That's, see, this is the problem. I have a whole bunch of other websites that are all HTML5 and JavaScript and all this nonsense. And then this website for Kernel Shark was very, very nice, very, very fast, no problems. And see, I can use, if I run this browser on Linux, I can use Kernel Shark to figure out why this browser takes up so much memory. When I load Gmail or whatever, you know? Okay, let me try this again. So how to build Kernel Sharp basics. Oh, that is so cool. Oh yeah, look at that. Actually, you've got instructions for how to build it. It's easy to install it, but you've even got easy instructions for how to build it. And it's like three lines of apt-get or three lines of Fedora specific instructions. And then git clone and then build, make GUI, you know? Ah, yeah. That's awesome. Very cool. Really great. I appreciate your time. Where do people learn more about you? Are you on the internet? Are you out there?
I don't have my own website or something like this. But no, if Twitter? You want to learn more about the project, just Google it, and you see many of the talks we've been giving on different open source events are recorded and are available on YouTube. So if you just Google Kernel Shark, you get a lot of conference presentations. That's a good place to start. Yeah.
Okay. So Kernel Shark, they can Google it. You have no Twitter or anything?
Well, I'm kind of an old school person. I don't have Twitter.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. Really, 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 thank you so much for your time and for introducing me to this amazing tool.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any last words, anything you want people to know?
Well, if you want to know more, especially for the new feature that we are developing and which will be available with Kernel Shark 2.0. Just stay tuned.
Yeah.
We'll keep presenting at all major open source events. So, yeah.
That's awesome.
Stay tuned.
Wonderful. All right, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you.
A Bootiful podcast is produced by me, Josh Long. I do these podcasts because I believe that everything we do in software is for and made better by people. I want to hear from you. I'm josh@joshlong.com by email or @starbuxman on Twitter, where, of course, my direct messages are wide open. Do you have guest ideas, topic suggestions, feedback? Don't hesitate to reach out. If you like the show, then please consider rating it on iTunes and leaving a review, as it really helps the show. I sampled music from Steve Combs' Them from Morning in Springtime and Steve Combs' Small Victory, both of which are licensed under a Creative Commons license. I'm trying to hire production assistants to make the production of this podcast easier. I want to make sure that we can add things like show notes and transcripts and just generally do more. If you would like to advertise on the show, then please reach out to me. And if you can't or don't want to advertise but would like to otherwise support the show, then please consider supporting me at patreon.com, patreon.com/Josh Long for as low as $4 a month. Thanks again. No harm came to any seasons in the making of this podcast.